could I ask Bill Herman from a place with a long title,
the Food and Drug Administration,
why he's battling with the technology. There's something significant in that we spent 5 minutes trying to get the technology to work this morning for a group which is into the use of high technology by old and disabled people, but we can't even get the damn stuff to work. But Bill,
thank you. I guess I should acknowledge at the outset that this is sort of a special purpose presentation. It'll be of interest to you only if you ever envision your systems actually being sold. That will have you going through FDA to get them into actual use. I'm going to move sort of quickly here, so I will begin with the bottom line. Excuse me. And that is that FDA, like developers and designers, is trying to figure out what to do about these entirely new sorts of systems that Steve was talking about and we've been talking about for the last couple of days here. FDA is groping toward an emerging strategy which essentially would enable us to stay out of the way as much as it's possible to do so of the introduction of new technologies when we don't have value to add. But when we do engage the kinds of technologies we've been talking about, to do it in a way that's well optimized from a public health standpoint. I'm going to talk first about the technologies that we at FDA are believing we will have to come to terms with over the next few years, and then I'm going to talk briefly about the legal apparatus and framework within which FDA operates to try to engage those technologies some way or another. We do, I should have said at the beginning, I manage physics and engineering labs for the Center for Devices and Radiological Health. And that's germane because the first part of my presentation here is going to have to do with technology forecasting. A considerable amount of technology forecasting goes on at FDA simply because the kinds of things that are difficult in really innovative technologies have to do with knowing what to ask in the first place. If time is not available to think about what questions we're going to pose to new developers, then we will, of course, be asking the wrong questions and useless things will transpire. So we do a considerable amount of technology forecasting. I'm going to talk about a couple of such efforts as we go along here. This particular one was a rather large-scale technology forecast that was done about 5 years ago. The URLs at the bottom there and all the details are up on the web. But through a combination of intramural scientists and extramural experts, we attempted to identify half a dozen or so major technology trends that were likely to produce many products over the next decade, and we're about halfway through the decade for which that forecast was made, and I think it's standing up pretty well with respect to the topic of our deliberations over the last couple of days. It's well worth noting that home and self-care and computer-related technologies were both among the trends that we thought would produce the most new products and, in some sense, perhaps the most radical new products. This is just a quick sketch of the sorts of people who participated in that, and you'll see, among others up there, stashed away on the right-hand side, Gilbert Devey of the National Science Foundation, NIH, and others. The kinds of trends that that we thought drove new technologies are very much the ones that you would expect. Demographic trends, very much like the ones described by Alice Pentland yesterday, squeezing of the healthcare dollar, and the fact that technology, in fact, enables us to do things that we might at one time not have done. I want to focus in particularly on two of the bullets from the first list there, the computer-related device trends and home care. A lot of new products expected that were driven by computerization in some sense, and that, of course, has turned out to be true. I think most of the things there are self-evident enough that I will just focus on two of them. The integrated patient medical information system that you think of as a hospital-based system is, in fact, one of the boundary conditions that was evident in Steve Warren's presentation just before me. The devices that are being designed will probably, in some sense, be plugged into, either directly or in some virtual sense, larger systems that will revolve around these patient information systems. And it's interesting to note that in this particular analysis and forecast, that group of technologies centered around the integrated patient medical information system was believed to be the phenomenon that would most radically change the practice of medicine over the next decade and more. The other one that I wanted to mention, at least briefly, is computer-aided medical decision making, which pops up either explicitly or implicitly in many of the presentations given here. And it's entertaining to know that while this was clearly identified as an area likely to be important over this time period, that there was a keen differentiation between the responses on the one hand of the engineers who participated, who said, absolutely, yes, he knows it already, and the clinicians who said, absolutely, maybe. home care technology. Again, lots of products anticipated. This is one of the likely one of the most active medical device development areas that FDA will deal with. But interestingly, there's a sort of bimodality here too. You see in the second bullet the point that the expectations for really sophisticated or advanced technologies here were quite limited. That is to say, the sorts of things that Heinz Wolf was talking about yesterday, the integration of relatively modest technologies into systems, is the primary thing that we anticipated seeing. The monitoring sorts of things here were mirrored in, for example, the blood glucose monitoring for diabetes that was mentioned by Irfan Esai yesterday in the Aware Home and that sort of thing. Obviously, the two bullets that belie this notion of limited expectation for advanced technologies are the last two, telemedicine and smart devices. But even there, it's worth clarifying that the sort of telemedicine that was imagined to make a substantial difference in the product seen by FDA, it was a very modest version of technology that sounded a great deal like Lutz Kubitschka's presentation yesterday, in which the patient might be connected to at most the local hospital or a local consortium of hospitals, something like that. I want to drill down just a little bit further into the home care technologies before turning to who FDA is and how they operate. As a result of the study that I've been talking about up to this moment, National Science Foundation and FDA decided to look more deeply and more broadly into the expectations for developments in home care technology, and we put together a second workshop on that in which Steve Warren and Gil and I were involved. And this was a pretty broad spectrum of stakeholders of all types in the home care community. We wanted to look at a broader range of possible developments and also a longer timeline. And the results are reflected here. You see here things that indeed begin to look like a little longer timeline. The prevention orientation of the technology mirrors things that were said yesterday again by Alice Pentland, and the proactive paradigm that was dominated Kent Larson's presentation. The consumer health model that was mentioned by Heinz Wolf yesterday. You can tell I was taking notes yesterday so I could, you know, hook these things up. I guess the main thing I want to say about what is there is that if you think about these for the moment from the standpoint of the Food and Drug Administration, what you see predominantly are numerous challenges with respect to assessment methodologies. These are not going to be easy products to think about from an evaluation standpoint, certainly not when they're hooked into systems. A lot of people have commented on that. I believe that this was underscored in Oliver Wells' workshop in April of last year, the difficulty of the assessment methodologies. So, given all that, what would FDA do about these things, and why would you care? Well, FDA, as you know, regulates a lot of things, foods, drugs, veterinary medicine, you might not know that, vaccines and so on. One of the things that it regulates in its Center for Devices and Radiological Health is the safety and effectiveness of medical devices. And if you're caught up in this net, what does that mean? I wouldn't have the nerve to take you tediously through the legislative background for what FDA does, with the single exception that the earliest piece of legislation dealing with medical device responsibilities and authorities for FDA is 1976. And the significance of that is that if you were a product that was on the market prior to that time, unless it's a product with egregious defects or a quack device or something of that nature, FDA has relatively little to do with you. That's of minor interest, since it's been a few years since 1976. What's more significant is that if your product is essentially similar to products that were on the market before 1976, then the same sorts of things obtain. That is, you have relatively little engagement with us. If with respect to many of the systems and products that have been talked about in the last couple of days here, it's a non-trivial question whether or not you are a medical device, whether or not, in fact, you do engage FDA. So you might wonder what it is that the law crisply says about how to make the differentiation. You can tell from the last two bullets that if you're a drug, you're not a device. And from the first two bullets, you can tell that if you're anything else, you might be. And if you are, then what? Well, in broadest outline, if you're any of the couple of thousand different kinds of medical devices that end up dealing with FDA, then you'll find yourself oriented in a three-tiered system, progressively more rigorous and intense regulatory attention. And that tiered system is a risk-based system, or at least intended to be so. If you start at the lowest category there, then the kinds of requirements that FDA brings to you, pardon me, are pretty minimal. They're pretty much things that you would do anyway. They have to do with whether your device is misbranded, or you have to register one way and another with us, get your products listed, have basic quality control systems and accurate labeling and so on. If you move up the chain to class two, now special controls may be added, and that there are a few things that might be, but most typical would be conformance to consensus standards. But finally, if you get up into class three, the highest risk devices, then you have you fully engage the pre-market system, and quickly said that can happen a couple of ways. One is you can either be a pre-1976 device, or you can show that you are in some sense equivalent to a pre-1976 device. And believe it or not, that's a preponderance of what FDA handles. We see thousands of these things every year. By contrast, if you are not substantially equivalent to anything, if you really are innovative, if you're a new device, then you, in our system of thinking, you come in with a pre-market approval application. You almost certainly will have to produce clinical data to justify your claims and so on. If you are familiar with the acronym IDE, it takes place under this rubric here. If you're doing clinical studies for a PMA, then the IDE is an investigational device exemption that covers the clinical trials for significant risk devices for basic protections of human subjects and a little recouping of costs. In the last couple, the last two, three slides here, I'm just going to say that the FDA has traditionally managed to get by with pretty much the image that you have of it as a reactive, gatekeeping, unilateral sort of entity, and that was good enough for an awful lot of things. But as the technologies are changing, FDA is attempting to do that as well. Bring in different paradigms that are more dependent on the kinds of information that are provided to the user, the consumer. To FDA is engaged more fully in a global harmonization, working with other people in the same universe on consensus standards and so on. And as I said before, on an anticipatory orientation to the to the kinds of technologies we've been talking about. Some kinds of considerations become much more serious with new kinds of products, whether or not you are a device, whether there really is adequate information provided in the labeling or instructions for your device. Smart devices, obviously, can't get through a talk like this without saying, what about FDA's software policy? Some of you may be familiar with the work of Paul Jones and others in FDA in developing a software policy that currently awaits the FDA commissioner's signature, and we'll see the lightning speed with which that occurs. That policy really will define whether a particular type of software is or isn't a medical device. It's fairly elaborate, but it's not, unfortunately, not publicly released yet. What one can say in a general way, though, is you can expect that the regulatory strategy for software will rely significantly on the use of standards for things like life cycle development, quality systems, and so on. Third-party reviews will be a possibility as well. Telehealth is obviously much more significant for the kinds of devices we've talked about. Interacting systems of devices, I grumbled aloud about this yesterday, that if you start connecting the sorts of distributed systems that have an open quality, like Steve Warren's presentation, then you've created a new entity. I mean, you have the system itself begins to have emergent properties that you would have to be awfully farsighted to be able to anticipate very well. Architectural considerations, FDA is not accustomed to dealing with architectural considerations. They obviously will be important here. Environmental factors, just as a reminder that something new and different happens when we have devices in completely uncontrolled environments. The sorts of things that will pop into your mind immediately will be things like temperature, humidity, that sort of stuff. But there are also other more complicated things like electromagnetic interference, which are non-trivial. And that's the last slide right there. What it pretty much says is that where the public health issues are not significant and we're not actually required to do it, you're not going to find us trying to get in the way of new devices. Even if there is a regulatory mandate in the upper left-hand corner, still if the public health issues are not substantial, we have options like exemption from a number of normal requirements. On the other hand, if you're in the right hand of this diagram, even if it's the lower right hand, FDA will certainly be actively involved in patient education, in user information, collaborations with clinicians and providers to make sure that home use devices, in fact, operate in some way that we would all, from a common sense standpoint, want. The upper right-hand corner is where the real policy developments occur. And I think there, again, you can expect to see more attention to things like human factors, but an application of horizontal standards for things like electrical safety and so on, adapted particularly to home use devices and more third-party reviews. That completes my talk. I would say, with apologies, with Alan's forbearance, Steve and I are going to be racing out of here to go give presentations at CARS as soon as this is over. So if there are any questions, we should probably take them quickly now.
Yes, please. Any questions for Bill or?
I have a question about the device used. Because we are putting more of these devices in patients' homes, and some of these devices are being designed to be used by professionals. But when we are putting these things in patients who are not necessarily professionals, and also not trained, how do we handle that?
The question had to do with the far more limited capabilities of users in homes than users in more professional settings, and how one can come to terms with that. It's a very, very tough question. I don't know that it explains anything for me to put it in the lexicon of some of these slides of adequate labeling and human factors and so on, but that basically is it. A device that cannot be safely and effectively used by the intended user with the information that's provided is not a device that's ready to go. Very difficult problem.
The study, the trend analysis, and the workshops were placed in 1998-99.
Correct.
Have you repeated any of that more recently? I'd be quite interested to know whether the maybe is becoming a bit more of a perhaps but, or yes please.
Another good question. As a matter of fact, we are more or less constantly engaged in technology forecasting, and every now and again it takes a formal form, like the ones in 98 and 99. So yes, we are continuing to do it. We will probably update those that more elaborate version sometime within the next year or two. And my sense is that they were pretty much on target. We're seeing about what we thought we would see.
One more.
On the policy requirements, does updated also mean elimination of the regulations that are no longer applicable?
Sure. I guess we'd have to get down to cases to answer that one further. But yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much indeed. We'll leave you to get to your next meeting.